Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is Friday, October 18th, 2019. My name is Daniel Bader, managing editor of AndroidCentral.com. And this week, we have returning to the show, Ara Wagner. Welcome back.
Yo.
How are you?
I'm good. Looking forward to some rain this weekend.
Oh, cool.
Which is a very weird thing to say.
Been dry, I guess, in Florida for the last little bit.
Yeah. And also, just whenever it rains, there tends to be less of a crowd at the park.
You go to the park even when it's raining?
Yeah, I just don't bring a computer with me.
Ah, well, you should bring one of those water-resistant tough books and see how much work you can get done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I can still bring my laptop and get work done. It's just a matter of everywhere you would want to sit down is completely stuffed with people trying to wait out rain.
That sounds awful. Jerry, that sounds pretty terrible. The man, the legend, Jerry Hillenbrand, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm trying to stave off a cough, so I'm going to apologize in advance for coughing in the background, and hopefully our producer, Jim, can mute those moments out. I'll try to keep them few and far between and let you two talk, because nobody needs to hear more of my voice. As sexy as this voice sounds right now, you know. So we'll talk, just a quick kind of disclaimer for this show. The Pixel 4, we talked a lot about it on last week's episode with Andrew and Hayato. Obviously, that was before the announcement, but we went through a lot of what we knew, and it ended up being true. So if you want to learn a lot about the Pixel 4, listen to last week's episode, and we will talk a lot about it next week, because we're publishing our review on, I can't say when, but it's next week. So just listen for that, and we'll have a show dedicated to our impressions on the Pixel 4. So if you're expecting to hear a lot of Pixel 4 stuff on today's episode, we'll talk a little bit about it at the end, but it'll mostly focus on the other products announced at Google's event on Tuesday, because there were a lot. And I think there were, you know, as a whole, they were pretty interesting, right? Individually, maybe not. But, you know, Jerry, I want to get into some stuff around Google's ambient computing, you know, goals and try to make sense of how it's trying to piece together Nest and all of its other hardware aspirations. But we'll start with the Pixel Buds, which are the products that are not actually coming out until next spring, because it kind of brings together all of Google's hardware into one product, right? This is a pair of true wireless earbuds. They are very different from the original Pixel Buds announced 2 years ago. They are obviously true wireless. They have no connecting wire. They're a lot smaller. They have a case, but they do a lot of on-device processing, which is why the machine learning algorithms that are inside the little, you know, chip are, they're still working on it. They're still improving it, which is why they're only shipping it next spring, but they're going to be $180. They look great. I haven't heard them, but they're supposed to sound great. Jerry, what's your take on a product like this? Especially given that Google is trying to sell a lot of Pixel products, and this kind of puts a shine around the phone because it's going to work best on a Pixel phone.
I think the Pixel Buds are a sneak peek at Google's ultimate goal. Google is a company that makes money through the cloud. I think they still lose money building phones and hardware and stuff. If they make money, it's not a lot. I know we're going to talk more about ambient computing, but this is ambient computing. It, you know, the baby steps. A device that you wear that you can talk to, and what they said, a football field away from your phone.
Right.
They need a connection, but they do as much as they can without relying on the phone to do it. One day your Pixel Buds are going to connect directly to the cloud, and all your computing is going to be done through your voice.
Is that a realistic way of interacting with your products, though?
Like, yes and no, because there's no display, and Google Glass certainly isn't an alternative. But that's something left for the future to figure out, whether we can get a virtual display that actually works, or find a way to compute without a display? That I couldn't figure out, but I think that's what they're trying to do.
Part of the reason that I'm happy with Google Assistant just with voice instead of having to rely on a display for so many things is it encourages me to keep doing other things and not engage my phone as often when I'm using them. That's part of why I have Google Assistant speakers. I have two of them in the bedroom. I have one of them in the living room, and I have one of them in the bathroom. So that way I can use it pretty much anywhere that I am and don't need to just randomly shout out and hope my hope one of my five or however many phones hears me. Because it just using your voice is easier and it helps wean me off of my smartphone addiction. Slowly. Very, very slowly.
But the thing that I'm not sure about is the actual information that you want to glean from a hands-free assistant, whether it's on your wrist, like a watch, or in your ears with a pair of earbuds. Is that really the same thing as what you want to accomplish on your phone? Like, we talk about triage a lot and how anything that's not a phone, but it's connected to your phone, is an avenue for triaging the various tidbits of information you need, and that it'll prevent you from taking out your phone. But what I've found, and what Google, I think, has acknowledged, is that Assistant's been too slow, right? It hasn't given you the information quickly enough, so they're putting a lot of effort into making Assistant local so that it is faster, but also that you end up getting a lot of, this is what I found on the web for blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, oh, that's not what I wanted. And then you take out your phone anyway because you know how to get it faster.
Yeah, but what I need to do most often is either control my music, start my music, set a timer, or call, ask for the weather, or call my mom. And with on-device assistant, I'm going to be able to do four of those five things without accessing the internet.
Right. Jerry, a lot of the stuff that's that Google's touting, on-device assistant processing, you know, they're doing it on the phone. They're doing a little bit of it here. We're not really sure how much of it is being passed through to the phone. But I mean, the whole reason that it's taking longer to ship is because they are trying to do as much of it as possible on the earbuds. What does that look like exactly? You know, is it literally running like its own little ARM chip that's doing some on-device processing? Or is it just that there's a machine learning, like everything's kind of running through a machine learning filter that is then passed through the phone to the phone so that the phone is able to get a better understanding of what to process right away?
There has to be two other chips besides whatever chip is doing the smart processing. There has to be something that holds some sort of operating system. When you turn them on, wires don't know that you need to do this on this chip. Wires are dumb. So you need some sort of controller to tell the circuits which way to go and where to go and how to work. So there's some sort of little miniature operating system. And yes, there has to be some sort of CPU. It doesn't necessarily have to be an ARM chip. It could be just a tiny microcontroller. But in essence, there is an operating system and a system on chip inside the Pixel Buds itself, probably on one single die with the smart coprocessor too.
Okay, that sounds pretty cool.
This is probably a dumb question from me, but when I was looking over all the Pixel Bud stuff, I thought the only special ambient computing stuff that was on the actual buds was a method for machine learning in order to better make out your voice and make out your commands before passing that back to your phone. I didn't think the buds, because you still need an internet connection. Right. So I don't think the buds do the actual Google Assistant. They just pass it off to your phone, don't they?
There's something on there that can do it locally in your ear. They didn't really tell us exactly what they can and can't do. They're probably not even sure yet.
Yeah, that's the thing. The current listing on the Google Store is very ambiguous about what's actually done on the device. And I think that's on purpose because they don't want to have to walk back a whole bunch of functionality in 6 months. So they want to under promise and over deliver. They know that like the fundamentals are there. They know that it, you know, regardless of how much on-device processing this can do, they're going to be pretty decent true wireless earbuds. The guy I spoke to, the product manager of this particular product, and he was telling me all about how the on-device stuff was added much later because they wanted to nail the fundamentals. They wanted to nail the comfort. They wanted to nail the sound. They wanted to make sure that they were designed in such a way that, you know, they could be waterproof, that the microphones were positioned perfectly so that they could hear you for noise, for a touch-free Google Assistant. They wanted to make sure that the case was small enough but had a big enough battery so that you could get, you know, three or four additional charges, that there was a wireless charging coil in there, which is neat. You know, all of these things are important as just table stakes for a pair of true wireless earbuds today. So it's really good after seeing how flawed the Pixel Buds were, the originals. These ones are looking like they're going to be just another great pair of earbuds. And you know, Jerry, we saw Microsoft unveil a very odd-looking pair of true wireless earbuds itself at the Surface event a couple of weeks ago. You know, they're basically like discs in your ear. This is nothing like that. I mean, this looks like just any other pair of earbuds, which is kind of good.
One thing they mentioned that, I'm sure a lot of other earbuds do it, but nobody talks about, is how the port works. And it also is designed to relieve the pressure so you don't feel like you're inside a tin can. That's one thing I hate about wearing cheap earbuds, is how it seals everything up. I know it's important to hear your surroundings, but it's also important to let a little bit of air in and out.
Yeah, I'm actually curious about that. You know, I've never, the thing for me with true wireless earbuds has been, if I can't find the right size tip or like a fin that fits in my ear properly to hold a pair, the earbuds in place, I just will never find them to be comfortable. But once I find a good fit, I never worry that I'm being too isolated from the outside world. Because most of the pairs that I use have this ambient mode that allows noise to pass through using the microphones. This doesn't have that. This actually has a port that's supposed to balance the pressure and let in a modicum of outside noise. Are you worried about that? You know, there's on one extreme, there's like AirPods, which let in all the noise. And on the other side, there's the Sony, you know, WF-1000 XM3s that are actually noise canceling in addition to passively noise canceling. What's your take on this strategy?
I was hoping I'm hoping that either you can block that vent in order to have like good passive noise blocking, or that there'll be some sort of mechanism to where you can block out more of the noise. Because when it comes to noise canceling, I'm on the block out as much as I can into the spectrum, because most of the time when I'm trying to block out noise, I'm trying to block out like 10,000 people walking around Epcot, so, and a bunch of crying kids. And active noise canceling doesn't work that well for that, but passive noise canceling usually gets me most of the way, and then ANC can help with the rest. So I understand not wanting to be too isolated from the environment, but at the same time, there's those of us who I want to tune out the world.
So we don't know much else about this product other than it's coming next spring. It's interesting that Google pre-announced it. I was listening to the Vergecast yesterday where Nilay Patel and Dieter Bohn interviewed Rick Osterloh, who leads the Google hardware division. And Osterloh said that the reason they announced it now, and even though it's not shipping until next spring, is that they don't have a major event until I/O, and they don't want to have to wait until I/O to announce these. So I guess it makes sense. It's kind of putting a stake in the ground. It's interesting that Google is actually going to ship a product early on in the year. They really don't do this very often. But it's, I think, you know, more wireless earbuds in the market is never a bad thing. So let's move on to Pixelbook Go, because I think this is where we're going to spend the bulk of our discussion today. Jerry, we'll start with you, because you have actually come out and said that not only is the Pixelbook Go a step in the wrong direction for Google's strategy, but that with the Pixelbook Go, Google's tablet aspirations are officially dead. And even though we knew that, it's not a surprise, they're never making a tablet again. Explain what you mean by that, because it is kind of interesting.
Well, the people that talked to them when they did the reshuffling and stopped making tablets, they kind of gave the impression that it's okay because, you know, Chromebooks fold over and we're still going to really be dead set into making tablets a great experience through the use of a convertible Chromebook. And then they release their new Chromebook that's not a convertible. And maybe it's me being too skeptical, or maybe it's me relying on my, you know, I've been doing this for about 10 years now. That tells me that Google just doesn't care about tablets at all and never is going to.
Well, I don't agree with that, but I also, for the Pixel Go, I also don't like that it's not a 2-in-1. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, I straight up, like, if it's not a 2-in-1, there has to be a very good reason for it to wind up in the best Chromebook selection that we have, because having a 2-in-1 just adds so much more functionality. At the same time, since Google is aiming for an ultra-premium device here, if they'd made a 2-in-1, it would have been too thick as a tablet. It would have been too thick in tablet mode compared to an iPad or anything else, because this would have been going up against an iPad Pro and a Surface Pro.
Oh, on a personal level, I think it's great. I hate 2-in-1s.
Jerry, what's wrong with you?
If I wanted a tablet, I'd go buy an iPad, because that's a good tablet.
I don't care about tablet mode. I want temp mode and stand mode. Those are so helpful when I'm using it on when I have it docked to my USB-C hub at my standing desk.
Then I would get an iPad case with a kickstand. That's what I would do. I think of a Chromebook as a computer, as a laptop. And I don't care if, you know, any type of convertible hinge is there. That doesn't take away from the experience, but I'm never going to use one.
So, you know, I spoke to some of the people at Google about the Pixelbook Go, and, you know, their justification for not making it a 2-in-1 was that it obviously saves price. The hinge costs money. They wanted to bring this down to a more reasonable starting price at $649.
Is that really, though? Is that still really an affordable price range for an M3 Chromebook?
Well, it is an affordable Pixelbook. That was the argument, that if you're looking specifically for Google's interpretation of a Chromebook, which, you know, is a little bit more careful than perhaps some of the OEMs. I mean, I'm just saying what they told me. I don't necessarily agree, and I've used it for a few days, and I have some reservations about it. Obviously, you know, we can talk about that, but I think that, you know, Osterlo was like, we have to get this down to a relatively affordable price for a laptop. And they did that. I mean, every single Chromebook, every single Pixelbook Go SKU has 8 gigs of RAM, which is pretty good.
At least. Some of them have 8, some of them have 16.
Yeah, at least 8. And what Google told me was that it was more important to put a higher base level of RAM on the Go than it was to put a more powerful CPU.
Right.
Because Chrome OS is way more RAM dependent than it is CPU dependent. And the bottleneck always ends up being the 2 or 4 gigs of RAM on most Chromebooks.
Right. And if you've used Chrome on a Mac, you know that completely. The sandboxing that even the Chrome browser does just eats your RAM.
It's crazy. And, you know, Google was saying how they wanted to hit 12 hours of battery life across all of the SKUs. And there are 4 SKUs here, going from an M3 with 8 gigs of RAM.
I just want to know how they're going to do that with the most powerful processor and a 4K display on that $1,400 one.
Oh, there's a 57 watt hour battery in it. So it's
so that one got a bigger battery.
It's got a bigger battery as a result. So it's a little thicker. But that's how they're getting the 12 hours on it.
And you get a lot better battery life with more RAM in Chrome, because it literally saves a state of whatever window you were working on and then switched away from. And when you go back to it, it's just instant. There's no processing power needed.
So this is a you know, what's interesting is that it looks really different from the Pixel Book, right? It's a rounded chassis. It's painted magnesium instead of aluminum and glass. It doesn't have that. It's like, you know, a typical clamshell. It does not have a 2-in-1 hinge. It's got the same keyboard or a little bit of a, you know, an upgraded version of the Pixelbook keyboard, which is awesome. And it has a glass trackpad that's about 20% larger than the one on the Pixelbook. Also fantastic. So the fundamentals are there. But Jerry, this does not support the Pixel Pen, even though it has right. a touch screen. It is, you know, the screen only goes up to 400 nits, which I found to be problematic in direct sunlight. It's got nothing really to differentiate it from a lot of the other, you know, reasonably priced, but not like entry level Chromebooks out there from Asus, Acer, HP, Dell. So what's really the point? Yeah, Ara, I'll get to you in a minute because I know you have opinions on this, but what's really the point of releasing this product then?
I'm not sure. I mean, I wrote something that, you know, I didn't mean to trash the Pixelbook Go, but I kind of did. It's if you are a fan of Google's laptops, and I've had every one of them, this is not a step forward. This is a pixel slate inside a clamshell. Let's be honest. That's what it is. It's got that same weird screen. It's soft and it's round and it's just different from the Pixelbook by miles. It's not even close. And then they've taken away some of the things that made the Pixelbook great. The more I think about it, the more this tells me there's going to be a Pixelbook 2.
I mean, yeah, that it'll happen probably next year.
Yeah, this isn't Google's vision forward for their ultra premium Chromebook. This is Google's cheap Chromebook, even though it's not really cheap.
I was about to say, it's a cheap Chromebook that is more expensive than like 85% of the Chromebooks on the market.
But it's also better than 85% of the Chromebooks on the market.
Is it though?
Yes.
All right, so walk us through that. You use more Chromebooks than anybody I know. So, you know, take a look at something like the Asus, you know, Chromebook Flip C434. It's a, you know, relatively high powered, you know, premium Chromebook, but it's still cheaper than the entry level Chromebook, Pixelbook Go.
Yeah, like comparing the M3 Pixelbook Go to the C434, the 434 has a bigger screen. It has the 2-in-1 form factor and is like $100 to $150 less.
But it's also only got 4 gigs of RAM. And
yeah,
that's, as we said, like if you want to go up to 8 gigs, it's still cheaper than the entry level Pixelbook Go. It's only $600. But I guess my question is, have we gotten to the point yet where Chromebooks can actually take advantage of that additional power?
Yeah, they can take advantage of that additional power, but it's going to be one of those things that you're only going to really, really care if you have an i5 or an i7, if you're doing intensive gaming, if you're doing intensive Linux apps. Most of the time, you're not going to need that i5.
What about Android apps?
Even with Android apps, I don't think you need the i5 and the i7 that often.
Because I was using, like I have been using the Pixelbook Go as my daily driver. And one thing that I've noticed is that apps that are even optimized for the Chromebook, like Adobe Lightroom, they're kind of trash still. They're not smooth. They're not nearly as smooth as they are on an Android phone. And they're not nearly as smooth as the native versions on Mac or Windows. So they're sort of in this purgatory, and we're talking about this in 2019 the same way that we were in 2017.
To be fair, I mean, Adobe's just kind of trash for not properly for not giving us proper creative suite apps for Chromebooks. Because I'm sorry, they know that they could do better than this for Chrome, and they should, considering Chromebooks are what's used in a growing majority of schools.
Those are coming, I think. 2012, they're going to be here, is what they promised us.
Exactly. That's my freaking point. This is 2019 and we're having the same conversation.
I mean, I've stopped using Photoshop unless I'm breaking out Russell's old Surface Pro 3. I use Google Photos to edit anything that I've taken, and I use Pixlr Editor to edit anything that I didn't take.
The good news, though, is that that's got to come because full-blown Adobe Creative apps are trash on the Surface Go, and they're going to be trash on the next MacBook Air, too, because they're different. They need the kind of power and the kind of layout that you get from a full-blown Surface laptop or a desktop, and that's something Adobe is going to have to move away from.
Jerry, Photoshop ran better on my decade-old desktop PC than it did on the Surface Go, and that's insane.
Yeah, it's just weird, and it speaks to a lot of the inconsistencies in the Chrome experience, where so much of it is smoother, more intuitive than anything on Windows, even Mac. It's not as bogged down. You know, you get your updates in the background. It's just an amazing experience. And then you open a couple of apps, some of the power user apps that you would need in order to use this as a daily driver over a Windows or Mac PC. And you're like, oh, right. That's where things get stuck.
I disagree with that because I don't think how many people actually use Photoshop or intense photo editing stuff besides bloggers and media people?
A lot of people. I mean, I'm not talking about like using Lightroom as for your job, but a lot of people do use Adobe programs in general just to do light edits. And, you know, it's
why? Why would you pay for that?
Because they're powerful and they're capable and they're, and you know, they purport to offer all these features that other apps don't. And the insulting part is that Adobe has said over and over again, and Google has trumpeted those features as being optimized for Chrome. And, you know, the definition of optimized is extremely, it changes depending on who you're talking to.
That's what I was going to say a minute ago. Is a good example is look at the Chrome browser. The Chrome browser on even a cheap Chromebook is way better than you would think if you have just used the Chrome browser on any sort of desktop or MacBook. What Google has done to optimize for a Chromebook is like the peak of the mountain. And what all the other companies have done is like, you know, the bare minimum and okay, it'll run. So ship it. And there's a lot of room left where they could make, Lightroom work really great on a Chromebook if they wanted to.
So then what's holding them up? What's the issue?
Adobe don't care.
To be frank, the only Chromebooks that really sell outside of the education and business sector are the super cheap Chromebooks that have really low power processors and just 2 gigabytes of RAM. And the people that are buying them are never going to shell out $40 a month for Adobe Creative Cloud. So Adobe doesn't care.
Doesn't have to be 40. It's the Photoshop and Lightroom bundle is $10 a month. Look, I get it. It's a relatively niche audience, but it's also indicative of some of the limitations of Chrome OS and some of the problems advertising a Chromebook as a productivity machine. You know, we talk about this all the time with iPad, right? Google goes up against the iPad all the time as saying that the Chromebook is a superior choice because it's cheaper and you get more mileage for your dollar. But when the iPad is almost completely the opposite, whereas it excels in things like photo and video editing, especially with touch. But you need a keyboard add-on, and those are pretty expensive, and some of them are kind of bad in order to turn it into like a basic word processor. And Google just offers all of these services natively for free. So it's like two ends of the spectrum, and none of them are perfect for what most people need.
But part of why I think the value Chromebooks work. And the best-selling Chromebook today, I believe, is the Lenovo C330, because it's awesome, and that's what I've used for the majority of this year since you gave it to me, Jerry, is a $250 Chromebook with 64 gigabytes of storage, 4 gigabytes of RAM, and it runs all day. And yeah, I get that for video and photo. For video and photo editing, the power user will never be satisfied on a Chromebook. But for the people who just want to surf Facebook, do edit the photos that they took on their vacation, and play some solitaire, the Chromebook is all they need. I went and looked at an apartment yesterday, and the leasing agent, the moment I said I looked at, I wrote about phones and laptops, she was like, oh, so do you like MacBook? And I immediately just like, I ran back to my car to grab my Chromebook and show her, because she was just blown away by what a $250 touchscreen computer could do.
But this isn't unique to Chromebooks. You can go out and buy a $250 Windows laptop, and then when you try to run...
Yeah, but within a year and a half, it's going to be crap.
Well, even today, try to run Photoshop on it. You're going to hate yourself. Yeah. And I don't mean a Surface Go. I mean, you know, something cheap from Dell. Or, you know, any of these
even just the Windows version of the 3330. Lenovo, for a lot of these less expensive laptops, there's a Windows version and there's a Chromebook version. And the Chromebook version is better just because it's going to be more stable. Yeah, you're not going to be able to run Photoshop and Premiere on it, but you wouldn't want to run Photoshop and Premiere on that hardware anyway. Because, God forbid, we optimize these things properly.
Yeah, and I think the things that... And maybe I'm wrong, but I think the things that most people want to, that buy a $200 laptop, I think the things that they want to do, they could do better on a Chromebook than they can on a Windows computer.
Right. It's almost about finding the right combination of things that you need, and then just, you know, the features and services that you need, and then finding the best platform for that. You know, if you don't, you know, I agree with you. Like, my biggest thing is I need photo and video editing, and Chrome OS has always been lacking in those options. And whereas most people don't need that, and Chrome OS is probably a better option than Windows or Mac than for everything else.
I use my Pixelbook probably 90% of the time when I'm not working and 50% of the time when I am. But if I have to use a laptop and I have to edit even one picture, I pull out my MacBook Pro.
I've done most of my photo editing for the last 4 months on my on the Lenovo or whatever Chromebook I have handy. Because Google Photos gives me enough of the Lightroom type editing to get it where I want it. And I can pull out the Lightroom app if I really need to tweak it, but Google Photos has been decent enough for me. And if I need to crop out or get rid of any text in like a product render for one of our collections, Pixlr Editor is more than enough for it.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's great and for stuff like that.
Can you tell that my article photos for the last 9 months have been edited on a Chromebook?
Yes, they're trash. You're fired.
You're so mean. They aren't that bad. One of them got mentioned. I got mentioned a lot in those presentations at the beginning of the year. I remember.
Look, it's something to think about, right? The conveniences afforded by having a Chromebook outweigh any of the downsides. I will acknowledge that, and I love it. It's worth acknowledging that if Google, especially with something like the Pixelbook line, is, you know, $999 for the original Pixelbook is kind of absurd, and it probably sold in absurdly low numbers, but a $649 entry, you know, level for the Pixelbook Go makes it a little bit more accessible to the average consumer. And as a result, you're like, let's think about this in the context of other high-end Chromebooks, you know, because then it's almost the same price as the aforementioned Asus or HP or Dell or whatever. And in that case, what does it do better than those products? And it's unclear, other than this is just it's like a project for Google, and I don't know what the project is meant to actually achieve.
I think it's meant to keep the Pixel line somewhat current, because the Pixelbook is 2 years old, and even though it's still pretty bleeding edge with the processors and the specs, it's still a 2-year-old Chromebook.
I think a lot of it is Google likes the design. If you are really, you know, demanding that you have the best keyboard and the best trackpad, that's why Google makes laptops.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's still interesting because when you look at something like Microsoft and the Surface line, those are all positioned as extremely high-end products that they do not compromise on anything. The Pixel, the Surface Go, I think, compromised way too much, and that's why you don't really hear anybody talking about it except Russell. And you know, I love Russell,
I really want to steal Russell's for like an afternoon and see just how well it holds up.
It doesn't.
I've only gotten to spend an hour with a Surface Go.
I bought a Surface Go. I used it as my daily driver. I returned it after 4 days. I could not use it. It was excruciating.
But you couldn't use it because you were trying to use it for Lightroom and Photoshop,
so
right?
So is Russell. And he still manages. It's completely underpowered. Even as a browser, it was underpowered. All right. It wasn't just about opening up Lightroom and Photoshop. I barely tried those. I mean, I don't think I ever opened Photoshop. I may have opened Lightroom once after 30 minutes of waiting for it to open. You know, I'm exaggerating, but not really. So anyway, that's besides the point. But I do think it's worth pointing out that, you know, Microsoft has acknowledged this. Apple has tried to acknowledge it, but its cheapest computer is still $1,000 or $900. Although if you say that the iPad's a computer, it's, I don't know, whatever.
If it doesn't come with a keyboard, it ain't a computer.
Semantics are semantics. All right, let's move on and talk quickly about the Nest products, because I also think these were quite interesting. The Nest Mini is what it sounds like. It's basically a Google Home Mini with a much, much better speaker. It's a 15-watt amp. It's got better bass, but it's, for all intents and purposes, the exact same product. Still $49. I've heard it. I have one next to me. The sound is extremely, it's like night and day better than the Google Home Mini.
Is it the same size?
Yeah, physically
identical. Like, will it
identical?
Keep working? Okay, cool. I'm just really hoping that they bring the studio pairing option from the new Nest Mini to the old ones.
And it's made out of recycled pop bottles.
It is also made out of recycled pop bottles, which is neat. The fabric on top of it, not the actual base.
I think that's important.
It's cool. And I was impressed by the amount of time Google spent. I mean, it's a lot of patting itself on the back, which I get.
Yeah.
But it's for a reason, right? They did this before any other company was able to do it. And they're not just stopping with the Nest line. They're going to try to do the same thing with all of its hardware going forward. But yeah, I mean, if you're looking for an inexpensive Google Assistant, this is it. You know, it's great. And the new sky color is awesome. I really, really like that. All right. Are you going to get one of these?
What do I have? I have an OG Nest Mini in the bathroom. I've got the Sony XB501G and a Tic-Home Mini in the bedroom. I have this Insignia Voice with the clock on it in the living room. So, yeah, I guess I could get one for the kitchen, but I think I'm kind of full up at the moment, especially since I'm moving soon. I don't want to buy any more stuff before I move.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, if anybody is looking for like a replacement for the Nest or for the Google Home Mini and doesn't like the sound on that one, this is worth getting.
Daniel, I didn't even look. Does it have an audio out 3.5 jack?
No.
No.
Damn it, Google.
Echo still wins in that regard.
So The Chromebook audio is completely dead, or Chromecast audio. Google's dead. They gave that away too. I hate you, Google.
Well, I mean, Chromecast built-in is coming on how many audio-video receivers these days?
I don't know. None that I've looked at.
Oh, the one that my parents bought last year or the year before, that one had Chromecast built-in, and the only person that uses it is me when I'm home.
Yeah, but I want something to plug into the AV receiver that I already have and love.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I mean, it's platform lock-in, Jerry. They just want you to cast.
Yep.
Even Amazon acknowledges that you need to have a 3.5 millimeter jack. It's crazy. But let's talk about Nest Wi-Fi, because I'm interested in, Jerry, in your take on this. I mean, you've had a Google Wi-Fi, you've reviewed it, you've you know, Google says that it's the best-selling. It was the best-selling Wi-Fi mesh router for a while, and then it became the best-selling router on Amazon, period, for quite a while. It's a good product. There were some flaws, but ultimately the Nest Wi-Fi just builds on that. They say
that.
Do you
know what's crazy?
What?
The Nest Wi-Fi on pre-orders only is already number 62 out of all the routers Amazon sells. People must love this.
And the SKU that Amazon's selling is not really the standard one, which is
right,
strange.
It's weird.
So let's break it down. So you get the router, and then you get points. So the main combination has one router and one point. It's $269. And the point is itself a Nest Mini, essentially. So it has a microphone and speakers, and you put that in whatever room you want that would give you good Wi-Fi, but also it'll add a Google Assistant input and output into that room. So it's a genius idea, I think. It really, really works. Google says that the base model of one router and one point will fill the same amount of coverage as the three-pack Google Assistant or Google Wi-Fi router, because the base is way more powerful. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, first off, I have a little bit of issue with that, because as somebody who uses Google Wi-Fi, and I don't live in a cracker box, I don't have a huge house, three of them is too much. If I keep three of them running in my house, there are certain places in my home where it doesn't know which one to connect to, and it'll connect to the one that's too far away, and I don't get near as good of a signal as I would if it connected to the closer one. If they have amped up the coverage area and they don't include any sort of assistant features on the base unit, that's kind of dumb. I would love to see assistant built into the base unit, because for anybody that's in an apartment, that's all you're going to need.
Yep. I'm going to be moving to a two-bedroom, and I do not need more than one router in this puppy.
If you can get two, if you get the base and a satellite so you can have assistant, it's going to interfere with the way a mesh router system is supposed to work, because they're going to be too close together. That's something I can't believe that they let out the door, so I'm hoping I'm wrong and there's some sort of better intelligent switching in there.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
I mean, the base point system that they put out makes sense to me only because the first one is where you plug in the Ethernet, right? And then all the rest of them just connect to the Wi-Fi.
Right.
The original Wi-Fi, right? Then the first one doesn't need to have Google Assistant into it, because wherever you're plugging into the Ethernet is probably in a corner somewhere. In most houses.
But if it still covers your entire apartment and you hook up a satellite, if it doesn't have any better handoff capabilities than Google Wi-Fi does today, there are going to be plenty of times where you don't switch to the router that's close to you and your signal's not going to be as good.
But if you live in an apartment, you're not going to buy the big one and the point. You're just going to buy the router and use a Google Assistant speaker
alone. So if you buy just the big one, you're also going to have to buy a Nest Mini standalone,
which is still cheaper, right? So
which is still way cheaper. And I mean, heck, I'm willing to bet at Black Friday, if you buy just the big one, they'll give you a new Nest Mini.
But they could have stuck a microphone and speakers in the base unit and solved this problem.
It's probably a matter of size, heat output, things like that. The Nest router has a much, you know, the base has a faster CPU. It has more RAM. It has a 4x4 MIMO antenna rather than a 2x2 on the point. So they didn't want to make it bigger than the point, but they probably couldn't find a way to do both. But yeah, to Ara's point, just buy yourself a Nest Mini and love your life.
And I'll have to double check.
Or just use the app. I mean, come on.
Or, I mean, Google.
Is it that hard to pull out your phone?
Google also said that most people, so they did a lot of research into this, and they found most people already have if they're going to have a Google Assistant. So the router is usually in the living room near the TV. That's where most people's routers are set up. Some people's are tucked away in a basement somewhere, but the vast majority, it's in like a cupboard or a shelf or something in the living room. And as a result, they most people already have some sort of assistant in that room. So that's the reason. It wasn't so much, they just didn't want to double up unnecessarily and increase the cost. Whereas, you know, most people don't necessarily have a Nest Mini or Google Home Mini in their bedroom or in their, you know, I don't know, what wherever you put a Wi-Fi point.
Wherever your dead zone is. So, doesn't matter what room it is. Wherever your dead zone is, that's where it goes.
I'm really curious to check out the hardware when these actually get in people's hands, because some of the things I'm reading, especially, and if you're a nerd, it's 4x4, but it can be split into two 2x2 streams. That kind of sounds like it's got to have one of the new Qualcomm processors, especially designed for Wi-Fi 6. And this is not a Wi-Fi 6 capable router, which blows my mind.
Yeah, so I talked to Google about that as well, and their reason was Wi-Fi 6 is optimized for high-density areas like stadiums and airports, that there aren't enough clients available yet that support it, so it's not worth integrating it for the added cost and heat, because the Wi-Fi 6 chips inside all of these routers are very, very inefficient compared to the current generation of Wi-Fi 5, you know, components.
Yeah.
And generally, it's just not worth the trade-off. So most consumers won't take advantage of it. And what they said was, like how the Google Wi-Fi is backwards compatible with the Nest Wi-Fi. So if you buy a Nest Wi-Fi router and you already have a bunch of Google Wi-Fi points, you can actually make those into the access points, which is great. You can't make a Nest Wi-Fi router or point into a Google Wi-Fi point, but you can do it the other way around.
Which is awesome.
So what that means is that the next generation Nest Wi-Fi will be backwards compatible too. So that'll probably be Wi-Fi 6, which means you'll have a Wi-Fi 6 capable base. And then for the mesh points, you can have Wi-Fi 5 and whatever.
I also heard some rumors that in the future, they're going to release a standalone mesh node that does Wi-Fi 6 routing that you put in between your modem and the Nest Wi-Fi. I don't know how true that is, but I've heard it from several different people. If so, that's cool too.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I just want to know who upgrades their routers this often.
Which is why not including Wi-Fi 6 blows my mind. Today, I know, you know, everybody in tech likes to talk about new cool stuff and why we all should have it. Nobody in their right mind absolutely needs a Wi-Fi 6 router right now, because at most, only one of the things in your house is capable of using it, your phone. That's going to change, and it's going to change with the products we see announced at CES. So next year at this time, that's not going to be a true statement, and that means you will need to upgrade your Wi-Fi access points again.
Will it, though? You don't need it. I don't even have a Wi-Fi 5 router right now, I don't think, unless the one that Spectrum gave me is, because Spectrum made me take their router and modem when I moved into this apartment. I don't know if having Wi-Fi 6 is going to matter that much for the next in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, it's the 5G argument, right? The replacement cycles for products are getting longer. People are happy with their tech, and generally Wi-Fi works. So the most important thing to solve was not speed, it was coverage. And as a result, Google is focusing on coverage, not speed. That being said, adding 4x4 MIMO to the base is probably going to increase speed quite significantly.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, that's something to think about. And also, you know, Jerry, we don't have to get into it now because we don't want to get too into the weeds, but this is one of the first routers to support WAP3 encryption, which is interesting because it's not necessarily better.
No, not at all. not yet.
But it will be one day. So, okay, let's take a break and we'll thank our sponsor, and then we'll come right back and finish up talking about Pixel 4. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. So buying clothes is probably one of the least popular things that many people can do. It's annoying. You have to deal with lines, or if you're buying online, you don't know what you're getting. But Mack Weldon is different. Mack Weldon offers premium men's essentials that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. So what does that mean? Well, when you shop on their really easy to browse website, you can choose from a variety of items, including underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants. And they're all super, super comfortable. They even have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means that they get rid of your odor, which can sometimes be less than awesome, especially if you're in public a lot. So why would you want to shop at Mack Weldon? Well, this is one of the easiest and most convenient ways to get high quality essentials. You may hear it in my voice right now, but I'm a little sick, which is why I'm really happy to have a bunch of Mack Weldon's warm knit products, which are really, really nicely insulating. They're powered by Thermolite, and they are perfect for this time of year just to curl up on the couch with a book, and they are incredibly well made. So if you want to try Mack Weldon for yourself, go to mackweldon.com and enter promo code ACP for 20% off your first order. That's Mack Weldon, MackWeldon, and enter the promo code ACP at checkout. That's mackweldon.com, ACP at checkout for 20% off your first order. And thank you so much for sponsoring the show. Okay, so we'll spend the last 5 minutes or so talking about Pixel 4. As I said earlier in the show, we'll spend an entire episode next week talking about our Pixel 4 review, our full impressions. We'll have Andrew on because he's doing the review. But quickly, what's your take on it, Ara? Is the Pixel 4 interesting to you? Is it disappointing from what you've seen so far?
Well, I don't want to say too much until I actually get one in my hands. The only thing that like straight up blew me away during the Pixel 4 presentation was that demonstration they did for the new voice recorder app with the live transcription. Because I saw that in all my years at the TV station just went, oh my God, where was this 10 years ago? So I think that's going to excite a lot of people. I think that's going to excite a number of people that have very niche uses for it like I do. Otherwise, I'm not sure what to think of motion sense until I can actually play with it. I'm not sure what to think of the battery until I see how it performs when I'm like in the park and playing Wizards Unite or Disney Emoji Blitz while waiting in line 90 minutes for Flights of Passage or something. So it's going to be interesting, but I'm not sure how I feel about it quite yet, especially compared to the Pixel 3a, which is half the price and 80% of the performance, plus having a fingerprint sensor.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's I'm excited to hear your take on it because you're getting yours next week, and it should be fun. Jerry, what's your take on the Pixel 4 so far?
I wouldn't upgrade from a Pixel 3, but it's my opinion that at this point in the game, Google is the only company that makes Android phones that gives a damn about security and your privacy. If you're buying a new Android phone, it needs to be a Pixel 3a or a Pixel 4, or you're compromising on the privacy front, period. You go ahead and hate me and email Daniel all you want, but that's just how I feel about it. I don't particularly care about the removal of a fingerprint sensor because I don't use them. Motion sense is going to be cool on the Pixel 5. This is I'll throw it out there. Let's see how it works. Let's see what we need to fix. I really am intrigued with the face unlock. I'm not going to use that either. I don't like to use biometrics, but I really am deeply involved in how that tech works. And it'd be cool to see it in live action demo is so miniaturized is what I'm really, really interested in checking out. But it to me, I mean, it and the internet's full of hate, but I think it looks like a really good phone.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of unnecessary criticism, but I also think a lot of the criticism has been justified. It just depends on what specifically about the phone you're talking. But I'm looking forward to talking about it more next week when, you know, we can talk about all of the features. Right now, we're kind of held to talking about the high level stuff, so it's not even worth it. But I like it. I think that so far there are some concerns with battery. I'll just say that, and we'll leave it there. So, Ara, Jerry, thank you. This has been really, really fun. I'm looking forward to digging more into these products and having you dig into it. Jerry, you're getting a Pixelbook Go in a little bit. Ara, you're getting a Pixel 4. Lots and lots of cool stuff coming out of Google. So thank you. And I hope you have a nice weekend because it's coming up pretty quickly.
More pumpkin seed baking this weekend. I only got a week and a half left to bake pumpkin seeds, so I'm going to be baking pumpkin seeds. And figuring out which Pixel 4 cases I review first, because the pile is growing.
Yeah, I got to try your pumpkin seeds one day. You make them sound delicious.
I'm going to get baked and go outside and play with a new little drone I bought.
What kind?
It's one of the ones that Thrifter showed off a couple weeks ago that I picked up for $100 instead of $300. I don't know the brand. It's not right here in front of me. But it's just under the FCC minimum, so it's not tiny. But I don't know. I haven't lost a drone for, a couple years. The last one I lost in the Shenandoah River. So I'm looking forward to trying to break and lose this one.
Amazing. I love these kinds of stories. All right. Well, we'll report back next week with your drone. You're getting baked and drone flying story. I can't wait to hear it. All right. If you have any thoughts about today's show, send them over to us at podcast@androidcentral.com. And let us know, are you interested in any of Google's products that they announced this week? If so, which ones? And if not, why? Send them to podcast@androidcentral. We love hearing from you. Okay, that's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Peace.